And it's funny because Kelly recently just started reading a bunch of my mom's old books.
From the, you know, 70s, first edition book.
Yeah.
Awesome, because I never met her. So we were a second marriage, and she was already passed.
Uh-huh.
Kind of nice to connect
with her. Books.
Books as well.
Like Be Here Now? Nah, not that.
Yeah, what were the subjects?
So, Wells of Abundance, The Magic in Your Mind, Creative Visualization, Spirit Fountain, so she got the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Oh, nice.
And you see them there on the shelf, you know.
Try all beer somewhere.
I know, right?
Well, it goes back. All my family yogi was she gave that to me. I was a years and years ago, and I just bought a new copy.
Been practicing your bilocation and hovering above the ground and stuff like that.
Yeah, it gets boring.
Yeah, I know. After a while, it's like, ah.
Sometimes it's a big thing, and then it's like,
yeah, let's just go out for coffee.
Yeah. You break your concentration, you just fall hard.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it hurts when you come tumbling down. Yeah, these conversations are a sort of alchemy, if you will. There's a quality of, let's call it consciousness or attention, which is referential. So we acquire knowledge and impressions and build a superstructure of, belief, loyalty, superstition, devotion, in many cases, religious, call it practices, ritualistic, right? And in this kind of encounter, our emphasis is not so much on the referential nature of consciousness, but on the incredulous nature of consciousness. And that takes that's kind of an acquired taste. As one gets a little deeper into it, I don't know if that's microwave or did you? Okay, good. As one gets a little deeper into it, it can be both exhilarating and intimidating. You know, our habit through conditioning and familiarity and conformist reality and culture, et cetera, is, you know, thick and has a surreptitious nature. So we become a product of prior knowledge, you know, the thoughts and beliefs of others, the movement of culture and race and politics and economics and a million other nuanced impressions that we don't necessarily take conscious notice of. And then all of that, crescendo of association and identification becomes what we think we are. And, you know, oftentimes we become proud and, you know, defensive. Whether that's, white male privilege or any other form of privilege that occurs within the context of civilization. You know, all of these, you could say, systems and rights and privileges and presumptions foment violence. And, you know, we can certainly see evidence of that violence, whether it's violence of speech, violence of the corporation, violence in a high school. You can go into the challenging aspects of you know, the devolution of ethicality, morality, and accountability that is necessary for a, call it, democracy to thrive. It's one way of looking at things. And we, you know, touch upon those things sometimes just for a little fuel. You know, a little rage is good to get things rolling. But the lasting emphasis of what we look at is really the alchemy and the nature of present experience. You know, we tend to be beholding to all kinds of authority, whether that's spiritual authority or political authority or the police state and all its iterations. You know, whether it's the church or the mosque or the Hindu temple, right? We have incredible hierarchies of belief and behavior, shunning and acceptance, right? That shape our, well, our relationship with the sacred, shape our relationship with the divine. We have a strong tendency to objectify experience and to anthropomorphize experience and to get profoundly befuddled and confused. So it's a very challenging walk to discover what, you know, one's, let's just say, pristine or unadorned nature is, free from the imposition and implication of all the compensatory mechanisms that human consciousness cleaves to for, you know, validation, security, survivability. Yeah. In a sense, you could say one's journey could include the question, what would it feel like, what does it look like to be nourished simply by one's contact with present experience? In other words, is consciousness unadorned, without agenda, without motive, without history or implication? Is it sufficient? Can we discover what it might feel like to simply rest in and as ourselves without accoutrement? And if it were possible, that might be a fun pastime. To the extent that we remain dependent upon events, circumstances, memory, acquisitive behavior, where we remain at risk, we remain apprehensive or anxious about what it is that we have accumulated and what it is that could perhaps injure us that we might lose. And that's, you know, physical stuff, as well as one's self-identity. So this is a... thanks. You could say this is a very casual encounter with a lighthearted, non-binding renunciation, in that there's nothing actually to renounce. No one really needs to change at all. But it could be fun to tickle the ivories and see what this feels like when present experience is not the product of anything and is not being held accountable, free from the myth of time, of space, of becoming, of any form of validation. many, you know, so-called religious or spiritual systems in lieu of providing or presenting a autonomous relationship, sell us trinkets of conformity, trinkets of join our club, trinkets of believe this, that the Buddha said, that Jesus said, that Muhammad said. And you're like, how about no thanks? How about what might it look like to be an autonomous, call it being, without being the product of any belief system whatsoever? And the discovery of, or the answer to that question, turns out to be exactly here, exactly now, exactly this. Our habit, again, semi-conscious if not unconscious, is to refer back to the habit of referential mind to tell us something about the truth, tell us something about anything, to place us in a context of some kind, whether it's time, place, purpose, meaning, relationship, all the various, you could say, aspects of context that we imagine we are the product of. So a referential mind is really just a hallucination machine. It manufactures adroitly, effortlessly, the imagination and imposition of context and content, which is, you know, self-satisfying, because I think I know who I am, where I am, what I am, why I am, what I'm aiming for, what I'm avoiding, what I'm trying to cultivate in my life. And so instantaneously, without skipping a beat, we become once again a product of referential association. And we, you know, live this way effortlessly 24/7, whether in waking state, dreaming, or even deep sleep. And even coming out of, you know, a good night's sleep, if we have the blessing of having an occasional good night's sleep, we spring into memory, recollection, and self-reference instantaneously, pretty much upon awakening, and then conduct our affairs from the lens or the patina of those associations. And we do this without giving it a second thought. And yet, you know, what percent of those of us living in the West are dealing with, well, opioid addiction, substance abuse, you know, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, etc., medications to get through the day that we otherwise thought should be cheerful, effortless, and nourishing? So you can see there's, you know, sufficient evidence of consciousness at risk.
Jeff?
Yeah.
Could you say something about Sangha and the value of a Sangha or like a group with others as opposed to being just by oneself?
Yeah, I can make up anything at all like anyone else can. You know, if we are fortunate to find a casual or informal community of persons that think blasphemily like we do, then, you know, that could be kind of a tribal hangout and be or feel yourself without risk of being excluded or shunned or made wrong. So that's that aspect of Sangha, you know, the safety of and community of like-minded people, especially if we trend toward being a little, you know, outside the loop of conformist expectation. Um, And in the midst of, you know, what you might call Sangha or the gathering of kindred souls, you know, your relationship with consciousness is, of course, your own. Oh, it's a kind of a fun paradox, really. You know, the only thing one knows is the texture and the pageantry of your own experience, your own consciousness. Everything else that appears in the irrefutability of your own firsthand experience. You know, like Course in Miracles and other help mates make it clear that, you know, the belief that you bring to present experience, the value that you bring to present experience is what you lay on it. What you insist it is, you know, by virtue of conditioning or some freedom from conditioning. So this becomes, you know, a resonant alchemy in that we're tickling the quality of awareness to outsmart itself and its capacity to see how it outsmarts itself. So you can imagine, you know, your or one's imagination to be of a certain nature, right? Everyone is familiar with themselves, the way they think and feel, and the way they feel and think, what they think about the way they feel and how they feel about what they think. You know, we're all very familiar with ourselves. We sense, you know, continuity, familiarity. And dabbling in this stuff, that can start to open so that we actually become acquainted with and intimate with aspects and qualities of present experience that are unfamiliar, which for me is, you know, a very thrilling and novel encounter. For others, it's like, I don't want to go anywhere near that. Some folks don't want to touch anything at all that is unfamiliar to themselves or the way that they experience. Whereas others, either deliberately or quite by mistake, stumble into, you know, call it dimensions, even though they're not really dimensions, where the the habit and the inertia of referential mind relaxes so profoundly that you're no longer acquisitive. You're no longer impulsively acquisitive with respect to present experience. And then it's just, I don't know what this is at all. Ever. Encounters like that, you know, can be quite lovely, but they're also very challenging because we, you could say, reflexively move away from a visitation from, you know, the unfamiliar, the unknown. Such is the habit of conditioning for context and content and presumption and narrative that if something were to occur, either, you know, by virtue of one's interest or just happen to you without preparation, it can be unnerving. But that's the way this goes. I could, you know, I could suggest just to be more bold about it, that's what this is. What it actually is unrelentingly strange, novel, magical, incomprehensible. And that's where the juice is. that's where the sacred makes itself known. That's where we're nourished. Otherwise, we, you know, remain a product of our own expectation, our own projection. And, you know, that might work for a while. And as long as myself is working, I'll keep, you know, putting quarters in the slot, pulling the handle. At some point in someone's life or throughout one's life, you could say certain discontinuities of purposeful success start to, you know, break apart. We start to fail. The habit of ourselves fails. And the ways in which we got connected, were nourished, believed in ourselves, participated in community, had a direction that we were going in, stops working. And you know, that also can be quite unnerving, especially if I've invested decades of my life in a complex identity that is starting to fail, over which I have no control. So that would be this. Present experience, if you give it just a little bit of room, you know, is the ruination of personal continuity. Present experience is exactly timeless, without space, context, content, or coordinate. That's what it actually is. It's luscious beyond imagination. But you could say it takes a little bit of yogic effort. In this case, yogic means the urgency to discover. Not necessarily breathing apparati and postures and diets and namaskars, namastes, pranams, and all of that, all of those trinkets. Yoga is the urgency to discover. And here you are. Here this is. The urgency to discover. The habit of referential mind, you know, will by nature come back in and track what it appears I'm referring to. And again, place it into context according to what I've read before or believed before or experienced before. And that's the nature of acquisitive consciousness. It takes whatever is happening, whether casual or magnified, and then places it continually in context. So that's how belief, you know, deadens the nuanced nature of present experience, because it's just, right? Enrolled and enrolled and enrolled in itself. And we think that's what makes us safe. I would suggest that's what actually makes us crazy. What would present experience feel like were we to get some relief from the habit to tell ourselves anything about it? Whether I'm happy or not happy, enjoying or not enjoying, why I've come to this meeting, what I'm getting out of it or not, whether I can, you know, put it in a takeout box and take it home. You see, the mind creates the mirage of self through the application of implication, context, content, coordinate, and then a value proposition. You know, is this meaningful to me? And we think we need this to be meaningful to us. But what if it weren't? Would it be okay if present experience was not meaningful to me? that the habit to always interject the imagination of myself were to just relax. And then here's this, whatever this is. I sure don't know what it is. And I'm okay that I don't know what it is. And the reflex of interjecting the imagination of myself to feel this a certain way, to convince myself of what's happening or what's not happening, is just silent, not operating. Then I'm no longer concerned, A, with what this means, and more importantly, I'm no longer concerned with the imagination of myself needing it to mean anything at all. So that's the collapse of centrism. I don't like the word ego so much because it's abused. And ego is, you know, too simple a word to meaningfully circumscribe the rich complexity of delusional consciousness. Ego becomes just a thing that, you know, you can accuse yourself of or accuse someone else of having, and that's that. But it's like, no, we're way too strange to accuse myself or anyone else of, you know, having or suffering from ego. This is an unfolding miracle. It's a dynamic field of impressions, transcendent from moment to moment. And even though, you know, one may have proclivities toward a certain kind of behavior, it's too belittling, really, to accuse anyone of having a big ego. And who has the right to throw the stone? Whose ego is small enough to accuse someone else of having too much of an ego? No one I've ever met. So I like to kind of steer away from that accusation and just sense this or oneself as a, you know, quite curious amalgam of, you know, imagined centrism. And that sense occurs through subtle, somewhat incessant value propositions. Being associated with the curious nature of present experience, anthropomorphizing it as self. As the reflex to impose oneself, the imagination of oneself upon present experience is free to be what it loves to be, what it already is. And that's a wonder field. This yoga is the yoga of, call it ruination.
Ruination?
Yes. Ruination.
The yoga of ruination?
Uh-huh. The yoga of cessation. Without having to follow a prescribed means or method. If one adopts a prescribed means or method, if one adopts the cosmology, whether it's ascended masters or a deceased relative or the Buddha or Brahman, Vishnu, Shiva, Kali, you know, on and on and on and on, then you're already the product of somebody else's idea. And if you're the product of somebody else's idea, how on earth are you going to be free enough to make a discovery which is sovereign and autonomous?
Uh-huh.
thankfully, present experience, it doesn't belong to anyone. Does not fit neatly into anybody's idea, whether that idea is the physicist's idea, right, or the fakir's idea. Nobody can know anything about this. And if that even is remotely true, then nobody knows anything about this. In which case, you don't have to rely on anybody's cosmology or ideas or implications or consequences at all. You're off the hook. Some of us might find that kind of refreshing. Some of us, that's terrifying. That's a blasphemy that is intolerable. But that's what this is. This is a blasphemy that is intolerable. Maybe that's why, the tendency of whatever humans are, whatever civilization is to indulge over and over again in the myth of authority, the myth of cosmology. Because the actual nature of experience is the blasphemy that is intolerable. And look at all of the exploitation that occurs, right, throughout history, throughout the civilization, in the present milieu, as concerns cosmology, religious, political isms, authority, the repression and suppression, the violence that we all, you could say, learn to tolerate with enough antidepressants to get through it. So as long as we remain, under the influence of cosmology and under the influence of authority, or remain in the the noble path of trying to set things straight, we're still a product of this, still a product of delusional consciousness. This is the nirvanic field. This is the welcome to nirvana sangha. This exactly is the nirvanic field. This is just this. If there's no expectation, if there's no measure, if the strain of becoming become quiet, if I don't need to refer to the imagination of my past or my person, then I'm free of it. I'm free of all of the mental, emotional, and call them spiritual accoutrements of the imagination of myself. Then I can just chill the fuck out. I don't have anything to prove to myself or anyone else. I'm free from the irritability of validation needs. It's easy for us to engage in, one or other form of spiritual endeavor and look for symptoms of its success as concerns my wealth, my parking spot, my hair, my relationships, my esoteric knowledge. That is trivial. What if you didn't need to have anything other than this? Nothing has ever happened to you. Nothing will ever happen to you. All you can ever find in the perturbations of the day and the perturbations of the life is the curious miracle of present experience. Accompanied, of course, by the incessant nature of narrative, which foments a sense of self, individuated sense of self, which is a story that's told. That's what we do. This is what we do.
I'm enjoying just kind of sitting here with everyone right now. This is kind of a good space.
Yep. We are unqualified and unqualifiable by nature. You could say it's more efficient to just take a few baby steps back away from the inertia of being self-consumed. Just a few baby steps back away from referential engagement. Then you don't need anything to be anything.
That impulse that we seem to have to orient, you know, it seems to come up quite frequently and naturally, particularly when you meet or when you relate, communicate. Okay, common ground, human.
Sure.
The five senses, history.
Yes.
Timeline.
Yes, amazing. You know. Yeah, that's right. The encyclopedia of yourself is basically on tap. The nirvanic field is the underlayment. And then the impulse that arises, right, without being sought, without permission, that you could say seduces one's mind or one's attention into narrative. Phew. It's too quick. It's too good. We go into, you know, storyline, whether that's an agreeable storyline, a disagreeable storyline, a regretful storyline, an anticipatory storyline, a blissful, right? It just instantaneously without our permission. That's how good this is at, you know, you could say suggesting or conjuring a dream. If we fail to see it, if we only imagine that we are the substantive outcome or product, then we live, you know, with the pressure of delusion or the pressure of hallucinatory association as self, which includes apprehension and anxiety and pride and violence and everything that humans are so good at. But the same quality of intelligence that is capable of driving us mad is curiously also capable of, you could say, witnessing the mechanism and the means by which narrative and association and a sense of self arises. Because it's outside that system, right? Your native intelligence, your unadorned intelligence is outside the system of conditioning. So it can look, you could say, at itself from a vantage point to see, oh, wow, I'm driving myself insane. And if you could say, if there's enough encounters with that simple, you know, revelation, well, something magical happens. You find yourself starting to sense the unconditioned nature of intelligence, rather than being, right, a repetitive product of the conditioned nature of intelligence.
I get a sense from taking that in that whatever it is that compels us to move in the track we're familiar with is eased, in a sense, by not going with the usual track. Now, what it is that motivates the change is, it's a curious thing.
Very curious.
I guess some sort of breakdown. I don't mean breakdown full blown. I mean,
yeah.
Hey, something's not quite. Something's a little off here.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you've identified with such a narrow band of life spectrum.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Spectrum. Yeah. It's a spectrum game. Really? Uh-huh. That doesn't mean that, you know, everyone welcomes with open arms the wormhole of expanded spectrum. You know, perhaps the all too often habit of whatever human consciousness is to remain, right, tethered to the narrow band.
Nature is the process, right? In the normal state.
It's an aspect, right?
We're in this situation in the process, and as opposed to, get this right, as opposed to truly being in the present and just being, as opposed to like thinking.
The processing is a superimposition.
Right.
On the
all those aspects you're talking about, which is the as soon as I'm thinking about in the present, now I've just sort of blown it because I'm ultimately going to use all those metrics that you talk about.
We jump into a companion reality of measure,
yeah,
which is the sense of self, and call it thinking, and the consideration of thinking occurs, you could say, if you want to call it frontally,
yeah,
right, in the neocortex.
Yeah.
suggests the hypnosis of a companion reality that is etheric.
All based on past experience.
It's too strange.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
As you really get kind of clear with it, the way that I might have been comfortable talking about it a minute ago gets transcended. Because you actually see the nature of associative mind, let's just say, hollow dynamically. And by seeing it hollow dynamically, the vocabulary that you might have used a moment ago as an anthropologist, as a sociologist, as a psychiatrist, is gone. It's gone. And so we're playing around with the, call it the very flexible membrane of working with what appears to be referential consciousness with a curious appreciation of non-referential consciousness that transcends it without effort. And that's what this does.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. To be able to articulate that and, let's say, meet each other there, even though there's clearly no place to meet, is a very curious non-condition. Because typically the mind stays enamored of the capacity of referential consciousness. And it has no relationship with the mirth of non-referential consciousness. But the moment you start playing with it, and then we, you know, arouse the possibility, entertain the possibility, well, you fulfill it. With no effort, you fulfill the possibility, the practicality or impracticality of non-referential consciousness. And then hollow dynamically, you see the blasphemy like that. And you don't even need to describe it. You're like, oh. But it could take decades, you know, of meditation and study and articulate, right, care and consideration and mentoring to mature to the point where you're like, oh, I should have known.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not so easy to articulate, but it's worth the challenge.
The thing I can think of is in a really good meditation where you are just nothing, in the best case, to be able to be there in the middle of like any moment.
It's so dynamic.
It seems hard.
See, the referential mind, because it only functions based on coordinate fields, the imagination of a coordinate field, it thinks that there's an experience to be had, or that there's a place to have it, and that it would be ideal if I could, right, achieve, accomplish, and remain in something or other. But that's just hallucinatory. This is too lucid to imagine that there could possibly be an experience that you or anyone would be better off having on a sustained basis. Another level of freedom. Now you're like, fuck that. I don't need to be having a quality of meditation. That's for meditators. We just keep, right? No matter what comes in that your one is capable of conjuring, this goes, ha ha. In a loving way. Ha ha. Oh, some ha ha. And then so we start to become, you could say, more cogently privy to how fun this is and the nature of its hallucinatory capacity to suggest that anything has ever happened to you at all. Nothing has. You can't find it. You can't find anything that's ever happened to you. Even if it appears as memory, as sensation, as belief, as photographic artifact, you know, as a YouTube video, it didn't. There's not enough room in the present moment to be both exactly what it is and for us to think about it. The thinking is always a companion reality that narrates, attempts to narrate what's actually occurring. But you can never actually inhabit what's actually occurring, because what's actually occurring is the erasure of the imagination of the person that thinks they're having an experience. And yet, with total ease, I can say, yep, I'm having an experience. It might be pleasant. It might be unpleasant. I can tell you why I'm having it or why I think I'm having it, what I'm going to do about it, if I like it and I want it to continue, or if I don't like it, I want it to stop. Pure hallucination. So the lucidity that starts to sneak up on you. No longer has locus. Good luck explaining to yourself or anybody else what it is, or even what it feels like. And yet, you have the sense, one has the sensitivity, the capacity, the inherent native intelligence to make that discovery, which has to be non-referential. It has to be, you know, holodynamic or whatever term, you know, is fun to use that day.
Yeah, because then it would be inaccurate the next day.
It's inaccurate before it's even over.
As soon as it's being formulated, before the words come out.
All reference is inaccurate.
Because it's a tendency to want to capture something precious, or something perceived as precious because it felt really good, or it opened something up.
Yes, or miserable, or unpleasant.
The mistake is associating the details with, well, if I recreate these details, I might be able to get that back. And it's all centered around, again, the false notion.
Well, see, but that occurs, and the way that it occurs is the genesis of self. Using the magical capacity for reference and coordinates is the genesis of self. Without using that magical wand, what is this? I don't know. There sure as hell isn't anything to defend. What would I be defending? This is just hallucinatorially rolling, streaming as a field of pure novelty, from which can be, you could say, fruit pluck that makes it look like someone's having an experience. But that's just a notion. That's just narrative applied. And the narrative that's applied, as profound as that capacity, magical capacity is referential. It's etheric. It's untrue. It's a value proposition.
There must be something like a worldly agreement that makes it appear real.
Well, we're all heading toward extinction, so there's your agreement. Or wherever we're heading. Sure, there's all kinds of agreement.
I mean, it's easy to create a hero that another being identifies with to look up to, which is both, you know,
blessed are the cheesemakers.
Caught up in that.
The cheesemakers?
Life of Brian. Sermon on the Mount. Did he say, blessed are the cheesemakers?
Right. Especially with all the cheese.
Hey, Prabhupada. Mm-hmm. On and on and on.
Right.
You know, Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah, so that any...
Jim Carrey.
...expounds a better self is really adding to the fiction.
That's all you have is fiction. Accompanying, what the fuck is this?
Right. But the fiction of it, you'll get it when, as opposed to, hey, it's going 100% right here, right now. Not when.
Well, you know, you can see that we can end up in a so-called accusatory and conclusory point of view as concerns a nirvanic field that will not succumb to conclusion or accusation. So we can say a bunch of stuff, and a bunch of people say a bunch of stuff. Sometimes you pay really good money to hear someone say a bunch of stuff because you like the way they write, or you like their background, or they play the guitar, or, you know, whatever. But it's just a bunch of people saying a bunch of stuff. This defies accusation and conclusion, because that would be, right? referential. And we're, you know, with all due respect to that, simply teasing out what you might encounter and discover as you pass beyond the boundary field of reference, as your intelligence awakens to the hollow dynamic nature of present experience and takes no prisoners.
So, to kind of drill down, think of your present a second. Really small, nobody, I can't hear a word in a second. And then if I were to drill down further, well, what about a tenth of a second? A hundredth of a second.
Sure.
A millisecond.
Yes.
Then it becomes much more easy to conceptualize what you're saying is that in a nanosecond,
yeah,
there is, I can't reflect on that.
You cannot.
There's press, I'm here. Like,
maybe.
I've been talking, it's been a bunch of nanoseconds.
Yeah, maybe.
But at that point in time, that absolute presence, that absolute point in time is nothing.
Go to Planck's constant and then tell me all your opinions.
No, just is.
I don't know.
Or it's not.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. See? It's like it defies even the most profound and poetic insight of nothing. It defies that. Right? It has to.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say, you know, tautology-wise, it has to. It has to defy itself. It has to transcend itself. It has to be smaller than small can be, larger than large can be, with and without space, and with and without time. Right?
Yeah. Infinite, but not.
Infinite and not. Right? Yeah, so it's you know, if you find a lily pad you like, well, spend a few minutes on the lily pad that you like. But you're going to end up in the lake. If I'm a carpenter, I have all kinds of ways of appreciating the poetry of wood. If I'm a scientist, depending on my discipline, I have profound ways of appreciating the poetry of that. Right? If I'm a mystic, well, I have profound ways of appreciating the poetry of that. So there's no end to the poetry and the language and the nuance and the ecstasy, the euphoria of, oh my goodness, what this is. Right? The Eskimos have how many words for snow? And we say, it's fucking snowy. Right? So why not, just for fun, just for the thrill of it, you know, utilize the disciplines that one has, right, cultivated in their life, educationally or otherwise, and see the miraculous poetry through that lens. Fantastic. But as we become, you could say, freed from the reflex to have to make this about anything, now you're in a giggle factory. Because it's not about anything. Just for fun, you know, you can conjecture, well, what might happen to civilization, to human consciousness, if a depthful appreciation of the fact that this isn't about anything started, you know, sweeping like a virus throughout the land. I don't know. We probably all end up at airports looking for sandwiches. Who knows?
Right.
And maybe the current malevolent conundrum that we're in is exactly what happens when everyone is enlightened. I don't know. I'd like to think not, but I might be lying or kidding myself. Yeah. Hey, if this, whatever this is and the way that it's unfolding, whether on the insect scale or the mineral scale or the galactic scale or the human scale, is obviously doing what it does. I mean, we're just dupes. We're products of the way, call it, consciousness has unfolded with the opposable thumb and the neocortex and the environment and the population and the technology. We're an experiment in situ. Nobody knows what's going on, even if there were, you know, Illuminati and 0.1% running the world and the, you know, Rothschild banking system and on and on and on. Okay. It's not like they're in control. I mean, tax legislation that favors the corporation at the expense of the democracy is disappointing. But, you know.
In the larger scheme of things, it's a stage.
It's, yeah, this is, you know, clearly whatever it is that's occurring is occurring at the whim of something that, you know. Got a suggestion? Go ahead, put it in the suggestion box. Maybe it'll get read in 500 million years on another planet, in another dimension. Oh, yeah, those guys, yeah, they were pretty pissed off. They went extinct pretty quickly. Oh, well. Yeah, I should have read this note sooner. I might have been able to help him out. Yeah, God damn it. Uh-huh.
Message in a the cosmic bottle.
That's right, message in a bottle. Sting wasn't kidding around.
Send me out an SOS. Oh, yeah.
So you could say this yoga, this alchemy, you know, well, it's as it gets good, and for some it takes, you know, for some they've already left the room. You know, for someone that's encountering this conversation for the first time, they were out of here a long time ago. That you two are still on the couch, someone must have put glue on it.
I'm here for the snacks.
Well, yeah, we have to have snacks to try to keep people around. Yeah. You see, so a certain kind of euphoria gets unleashed as we move, again, without effort or premeditation, from referential consciousness to non-referential consciousness and taste the mirth of the nature of being. Then it becomes a different conversation. It becomes a different kind of salon, different way to hang out. No one is putting the moves on anybody. As concerns, you know, cosmology, belief, superstition, behavior, nothing. It's a, wow, that's like, whoa, that's, where do you find a group like that? Well, in the basement of Pebble Hill Church on Thursdays.
It's the Pebble Underground.
It for sure is the underground.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, for seismic changes.
It's the Velvet Underground.
Orientation.
We actually worship Lou Reed, but we don't let newcomers in on that until much later. You got to be here like, you know, 4 or 5 meetings, and it's like, we really worship Lou Reed. Yeah, and we should.
Well, if you're going to have a reference, it's not a bad reference to have.
That's right. That's right. Pick a decent reference. Lou Reed's good.
Pretty educational when you notice your reference is so arbitrary.
Yes.
Like, unbelievably arbitrary.
Uh-huh.
And always outside yourself.
Yes.
Like, for me, always outside. And it just, you know, shifts with the wind.
That's what this does. You know, to make a spiritual claim about yourself is trivial. Oh, I had a Kundalini awakening. Oh, I did meditation. Oh, you know, I breathe with the divine. Well, knock yourself out. Gives a fuck. You see, the making of a claim, right, sets the imagination of oneself against what? A background of what? A background of what? A backdrop of what? To make a claim about having had an awakening. Awaken to what? What? So, you know, all of that shit, the Hindu comic books galore. The Buddhist comic books galore is like, get out of my face. who needs all of that rapturous nonsense that makes it look like, oh, I'd be better off if I were in a different condition, and so I will believe in the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, wear a brown robe, tell everyone else they're full of ego, and then get there someday. That's not going to fucking happen. You see clearly the irresolvability and the mirth of present experience as you get closer to the plank sensitivity, and you're like, go ahead, make a claim. Tell me all about yourself. That's freedom. Maybe. When you discover that all the nonfiction is fiction. As you discover that everything that's called spiritual is fiction. Maybe freedom is, you know, first of all, freedom's not that important, because freedom from what and for whom? For whose benefit? You're like, come on, stop. But the maturing of that view, and obviously it's not just a philosophical, right? If it's just philosophical, it remains it remains with mode up, right? In the high tower with the mode up. So it has to be, let's use the word textural. It's right. What is the, right? The call it the energetics of present experience. If it's free from reference, that's when it has some kick. You know, what anyone does with their life is maybe the best they can do with what they got. Whether it's circumstances and finances and ability and smarts and vitality and health and affection and community, or, you know, circumstances that are unwieldy, sorrowful, and tragic. We're not, turning a blind or jaundiced eye to the wave-like nature of human suffering, or pretending to be transcendent of anything. It's like Prasad. Everyone's throwing, you know, candies around.
I knew she wanted another one.
I love it. Yeah.
It is Prasad.
Yeah, so everyone's funny. Allowed to be the guru and throw Prasad. Yeah, it's very egalitarian.
That's really funny.
Yeah, you need some Prasad.
Supposed to wait till the end, but when does the end ever come?
Yeah, fuck it. Like the Shiva Bali yogi, right? Throwing Tootsie Rolls around the room. Very lovely woman visited us several Thursdays ago and had a direct encounter with what we're referring to. She articulated it quite poetically out of her own experience, not prompted by me. And, you know, my instinct is, you're in trouble. She hasn't come back since. We may never see her again. But in my experience, when a certain crack in the cosmic egg occurs, you get a taste of non-referential consciousness, you're in trouble. You can never forget it. And the kind of satisfaction or entertainment that you're trying to derive from your life has diminishing returns. In a sense, you are forced by that revelation to just move deeper into that process. But I don't know nothing. The cessation of yourself is not easy, or perhaps not even possible to forget. If you've had, you know, an inoculation of that nectar, you got to come back for more. Got to find out what that is. Mm-hmm. You have to get cozy with non-referential consciousness. You don't need Four Noble Truths or an Eightfold Path or the mysteries of the Yamas and the Niyamas, Raja Yoga, or shamanic empowerments. You just don't need nothing. This is direct, which is mainlining this shit.
Wouldn't you say it sort of meets you where you are no matter where you are?
Yeah, sure. Kind of does.
My tea bag says, you have not to find out the reality, you are the reality.
Even the tea bags know what this is.
You talking about tea bag enlightenment?
This is tea bag enlightenment.
That's so funny.
Let's say you wake up in the morning and, there's light depending on what hour you wake up, and maybe there's birds and there's a temperature and there's just unadulterated wonder. Full of miraculous, gleeful, mirthful, crazy, nuanced inebriation. This is the nirvanic field. If our attention is gross, meaning, seconds and beyond, mm-hmm. it loses the, right? Mm-hmm. The capitulation.
It's more difficult. The narrower it gets, the easier it is to be there, but
yes.
Wider it gets, the harder.
Yes. The wider, you could say, is a greater spigot of delusional,
right
impulse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why the contemplative arts, I could argue the contemplative arts are about slowing down and making still and cultivating a more nuanced relationship with the texture of present experience, so that the tendency to go into etheric narration quiets down, and then you have an intimate, nuanced relationship with right? The call at the nano level. Mm-hmm. And that is a whole nother companion field, because nothing's changed. This, shit house of awkward blasphemy is still exactly it. But it's being felt at a, level of wow. Yeah. And enough wow will, you could say, in time, were there any, obliterate the habit of self. We simply become naturally and organically nourished by the nuanced relationship, and the imagination of self which perhaps caused us so much consternation and hubris, evaporates.
Mental note, just immerse yourself in the shit out of awkward glasses.
That's right. Just yeah, I've got that on my fridge. Mm-hmm. Sure smells like me around here. God. You know, we don't typically learn this from the church or the temple or the mosque or the ashram or the zendo, right? Instead, you're just being given a bunch of hooey and invited into becoming a conformist member of, you know, of that cult, the cult of belief, the cult of other, the cult of you're no good, you're not enough. You're just, you know, you're born of sin, right? God is other than you. God is higher than you. God is before you. God is better than you. God is omniscient, omnipotent, omni this, omni that, you know? You're like, I'll pass. The Gnostic aspects of all these traditions aims inexorably to this nuanced, direct encounter with the texture of nirvanic revelation. That's all. Let's keep it simple, folks. We don't have to go to Madame Blavatsky or Dwal Kul, you know, to get any insider information. Because guess what? They don't have any insider information. There is nothing that can be known about this. There's nothing that's worth telling anybody about anything as concerns the nature of reality, because reality doesn't have a nature. It knows how to dream. So if you want to dream in my face, knock yourself out. You dream in my face, I'll dream in your face, you know, maybe we'll go out for coffee. But there's no authority. There is no one and nothing to look up to. That includes Brahman. Even though this is Brahman. And tag, you're it.
So the imagination, in order to relate to something that's beyond conception, they create, it creates an imagination. And then stories and, you know, and fascination.
There you go.
I remember just devouring books.
Sure,
yeah.
For some reason, just couldn't get enough.
That's right.
And entering into these worlds, these fictional worlds, that were just fantastic.
Hey.
It wasn't for any particular goal. It was just like,
yeah.
I was hungry for more.
It shocked you, man. Feeding, the great feeding. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Starting a Netflix series that's kind of addictive. You just
West saw
it right through it. Uh-huh. Just, oh. Yeah.
As it, you know, as the nuanced nature of attention, of revelation, you know, matures, passes through its own labyrinthine, right, texture, then, you know, even the cool and mirthful, wacky, serendipitous, odd, strange, right, of everything, dare I say, becomes less interesting. The immersive nature of awareness just peels away all of the symptoms that appear in awareness and becomes just absolutely self-admiring to the point of radiant unicity. And you're gone. You got nothing left, and yet you'll get to the toilet on time if you can. You'll have chocolate and pass them around because you're a nice person. And in the midst of what we refer to as the, you know, curiosity of human life, you are unfamiliar. It's very strange.
So when we create with our imagination something that's out of reach or extraordinary to the degree that it's just, you know, unattainable, we create our own irritation.
That's right. I mean, who's irritated you in your life more than you? No one even holds, you know, a distant second.
I don't think I've been programmed.
Yeah. You know, we are, our default, you could say, is to imagine that we're experiencing through the sense windows of experience, whether those are the five senses, right? Mind, imagination, reference. We think that's what's happening, that we're actually experiencing what there is to be experienced through some kind of a plenum. But that's not what's happening at all. If you're no longer the product or the recipient of a data field that's impressing upon itself through the sense windows, what are you? Who are you? You don't know. You don't have a thing to say about it. And yet the sense apparatus persists for as long as it persists. But that, you know, the, let's say the loyalty I have to myself, right, as an existent and continuing entity, perceiving entity, right, whether I call myself the body or the mind or whatever, no need. Now how free are you? Even the imposition of consciousness is no longer, doesn't, you could say, no longer floats your boat, no longer needs to persist. Though it's fine if it does. Why shouldn't it? You know, here this is, take delight. But you're not dependent upon this being delightful, because you're no longer the product of anything at all. Experience is a superimposition on nothing, on a causality. And you're like, wait, I thought I was supposed to get enlightened and therefore have a better experience, be more useful to people, right? Have compassion, maybe. Bring chocolates to a meeting. But no. Compassion is for Buddhists. And even the word compassion is a misnomer, a misdirection of the Pali, or the Sanskrit / Pali, of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a reference to freedom from the imposition of consciousness, which is a whole different animal than being, quote, compassionate. But the Buddhists don't fucking know that, at least the Western ones. They're just, you know, they're living under secondhand delusional hand-downs.
Well, compassion can also be seen as the fact that the duality is not really, really real. So compassion really is an extension of waking up, in a sense. Like,
well, yes, but be careful in that once you start qualifying duality as being something other than non-duality, or that compassion is a quality of receiving, perceiving, or behavior that results from the benefit of loosening up, you're back in, you know, referential expectation.
Yeah, I'm referring to a natural occurrence as opposed to a contrived, I got to do it or I might not make it through the gate.
That's right.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, right. People are running for the elevator and you hit the close button. Compassion.
Is that smack or something?
Smack.
Smack. Yeah. You see, of course, you know, language, because of its nature, since language is, let's say, an artifact of reference, language is used as a, you know, as a qualifier. So it becomes both accusatory and conclusory. You don't have to use language that way. You don't have to use conversation that way. You don't have to assign anything to anything as concerns what this is or what becomes of you if, as you, you know, open, you know, Adam Chaxfield can just fuck off. And I've told him so. Or Byron Katie, for that matter.
BK.
BK. Have it your way.
But why even assert to that degree, even? If someone's entertained or inspired or moved by something that they later find to have no calories.
Because I am a petty, rageful dickhead.
Okay, so you've owned it.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I rest my case.
Yeah, busted.
Nothing to push up against now.
Yeah.
It's kind of a self-narc out there.
Yeah, that's all. This is for fun. The reason being is that, you know, you go to the typical spiritual celebrity in today's milieu. And, you know, you commonly find cosmologies being sold that have to do with the enhancement of your behavior, the enhancement of your life, relaxation from the strain and pain of suffering. So you're looped back again in referential consciousness and becoming in sensuality and what's happening in your life and, you know, the secret, right? Just trivial hallucination. You're enrolled in trivial hallucination by these spiritual celebrities. And why do they do that? Because if they talked this way, the crowd would be this size or lower. You know, the crowd gets very small if you actually tell the truth.
So, in effect, not a draw of such events could be, and this would be more like smelling salts.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You don't have a future. And you're happy not to have one.
You said three funny things today.
That's a good day. Three is good.
Here you don't have a future. Lou Reed is our, what?
Our Ishta Devata.
Right. And there was something else that was really funny.
You come here to worship Lou Reed.
Yeah,
I hope the stream will stream in, right?
Whatever present experience is, it's absolutely free from even the slightest hint of any conditioning. That's that. Get out of my ashram. And that can be discovered firsthand. No fee, no vows, no funny clothes, no cushions, no candles, no practices, no nothing. Here it is. This is the nirvanic field for the taking, for the asking. There's no intermediary. And there's no need to make any claims. I'll be at the book signing table after the program. Come on.
The one we put on the shelf in the outhouse.
That's right. That's right. You know, we are vulnerable to celebrity, hero worship, mutant worship. We have to get over that.
Well, what's underneath it is, don't leave me alone with this.
Could be.
Something else I can sink my teeth into to not just
yes.
sink into this.
Sure, yes.
I want distractions, baby.
I hear
and
you.
And I want bells and whistles. And
I, yes.
Stuff to do and the Yellow Brick Road. And
that's right.
Stall.
Stall and defer. What's your name? Stall and defer. Bill Falderall. Yeah, so, you know, in so-called adult life, if for some strange reason, you know, your one's quirky attention to these matters is capable of being touched by hints of cessation, lucky you.
In the link that you had sent out that I listened to for about 12 minutes.
Right.
She was talking about it. She went through a phase in her life where, you know, just kind of like all interest in anything she's been doing just kind of dropped away.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I can kind of relate to that.
I can relate to that.
And then, like, it's come back. And it's come back almost with, like, oh, thank God, it's back.
Mm.
You know, I can engage and go out and make music and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing something somewhat philanthropic today, and I'm playing there, and there's a radio going. It's the words to Bruce Springsteen, The Highways. Broken Heroes on the Last Chance Power Dive.
Uh-huh.
Like, busted.
Yeah, busted. Even Bruce got you.
He did.
Yeah.
I gotta make something of this.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a speaker coming to Pebble in one of these ensuing Sundays that wrote a book about her enlightenment journey. And I was dabbling in some of her videos to get a sense of her message and authenticity and story and, you know, and what she had. And then sent out a little video clip to some of the regulars to enjoy. Someone made it 5 minutes in and threw it away. Someone made it 12 minutes in and threw it away. We're waiting for the person that can get through the whole video. I think Pat said she was. I didn't. I couldn't. No, no way.
It was just like on and on and on. It was not.
Yeah. It was just total bullshit.
It was.
Yeah. But see, that's what happens. You know, someone writes a book, and so that creates a certain kind of authority already because they're in print. And they have an interesting story to tell about their spiritual awakening and their kundalini and their guru and meditation and things like that. But when you really get in there and listen to what they have to say, it's just reference, 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 reference.
She could have been genuine. I mean, it is possible she was genuine, but the video was useless.
Yeah.
If I were to label this experience for me, it would be uncollecting.
Mm. Uh-huh.
Because you get to places and you collect something and take it home. Maybe you buy a book or maybe you read something, maybe you study something, maybe you practice something. And what this does is it eases me from those compulsions that, you know, to some degree, or the meditation that's more of an escape than really a sinking in, going deeper into to this without reference.
Yeah.
Without a new angle.
Yes. Right. Freedom from acquisition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Acquisition consciousness is referential. That appears to contribute to the maintenance of a sense of self. Here's this. Don't do anything with it. Don't make it into anything. Don't take anything home. Don't qualify experience. Here it is. in that way, the, you know, habit of reference, which is the habit of time and the habit of self, they just ease up. And a whole kind of curious quality of nourishment just comes up, descends, appears, is felt. A whole companion quality of nourishment is felt without effort. From the, you can say, the simple act or non-act of not making this about anything. Now the enjoyment is sovereign, it's non-referential. It's not codependent. Get used to it. If you want to sing Hare Krishna, sing Hare Krishna. That's cool. If you want to go to the Beltane in, you know, Maryland and take your clothes off and dance around the maypole, see ya. I could say with some, you know, mirth that nothing ever happened to you before now, and nothing is happening to you now. You don't have a story to tell. I would say that's dignity. I have no credentials. Just so you know, these conversations are not necessarily an illustration of what goes on at Pebble Hill. But thankfully, Pebble Hill has, you know, given us cordial permission and due, right, affection to meet here for the number of years we've been meeting here in this context. That we're grateful to the church and its community.
I'm grateful too.